We must talk more about Jung and love. Too briefly and too hurriedly, I touched this subject in our last session. Knowing there was no way to say enough, I said too little. I opened the worm can, and I did not confront the worm. Let me start again. I must speak about Jung and love. A woman can be the doorway, and then the passage of utter transformation for a man. Though often storied, in full fact, it is an exquisitely rare thing. But it happened to Carl Gustav Jung. All his life work began in a transformative passage, a relationship with a real woman. His obscurely meaningful words about opposites, anima, integration, and a hieros gamos, a sacred wedding, a conjunctio. These words were born in a mystery of love. I first heard this story in Jung's history long ago. I saw what happened, and I've tried to share it over the years. But each time I knew myself misunderstood. I did not have words enough, or words at all. The story was an image, a bridal chamber of mysteries, and still, it was a living fact. The mystery upon which this tale hangs is the story of a magic mirror. A sacred relationship which, seen reflected, thereby reflects one's own most precious self. Jung termed it transference, but knew the profound potential of the word in his own experience. Only experience fills this word with life. And then it becomes a magic key. It is the living story of transformative love. Liber Novus, the Red Book, is the precious tribute Jung gave to a fact of his life, an extraordinary and rare experience. I have asked of you, and now ask you again, to consider Jung as both a doctor and a patient. Look at his clinical history, and then evaluate his conclusions, his psychological writings. Weigh his experience against everything you know or hope to know about the psyche. Listen. Take your history. Take it carefully. Then draw conclusions. It is my impression that he would approve of this clinical, empirical, and historical approach to his work. Jung's life task as a man, as a physician, was to understand the nature and depths of the psyche, the human soul, the inner mystery of life. To understand it, he had to experience it fully. He had to submit. He had finally to descend into psychic chaos, the psychic chaos of himself. There was danger. He faced the potential of complete disorientation, perhaps insanity. What he did required courage, but I suppose he had no other choice. The task demanded him. He met abysmal solitude mixed with the anguish of unbearable longing. He heard the voice of the depths calling him, and he listened. He emerged from the chaos with a supreme meaning. The melding of nonsense and sense, desire and thought, flesh and soul. And in the ardent furnace of this alembic, Jung found the great mystery of love. It was an inner experience and an outer experience. In the darkest moments of his journey, in the winter of 1914, C.G. Jung was sustained by the love of a real woman. Her name was Toni Wolff. In love, inner and outer worlds touched. At the end of a long life, Jung pointed to this period and these experiences as the source of all of his work. I've quoted these words before and must repeat them again. The years when I pursued the inner images were the most important time of my life. Everything else is to be derived from this. It began at that time, and the later details hardly matter anymore. My entire life consisted in elaborating what had burst forth from the unconscious and flooded me like an enigmatic stream and threatened to break me. Everything later was merely the outer classification, the scientific elaboration, and the integration into life. But the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then. But the woman associated with the experiences remained in the shadow of history. One might argue that a man's philosophy, theories, and objective scientific work are to be measured on their own merits, and not against the biography of the author. But Jung is a man who claimed to have no theories and no philosophy. His scientific work was the empirical observation of the soul, and the most important clinical observation in his science was his direct encounter with his own soul. As he affirmed. One's own soul is the only psyche with which anyone has direct experiential encounter. Everything else is hearsay. The psyche is the most personal, subjective fact of all of life's experiences. Jung's experience, recorded in Liber Novus, granted the pattern to his work, the things he was obligated to share with others. He noted in 1925, while early in the phase of his labors, after Liber Novus, that he used empirical material supplied by his patients in his psychological writing. But, he said, and I quote, "The solution of the problem I drew from inside, from my observations of the unconscious processes." End quote. The pattern, the solution, the understanding, all came from his own observation, his submission to his own psyche. Therefore, if we are to evaluate Jung's psychology, we are forced towards two tasks. First, we must probe the empirical source of his science, since he drew that from the inside, from his own observations of the unconscious processes, and since the numinous beginning, which contained everything, was then, we are obliged to examine his clinical record, his history, his documentation of a journey to the inside. Second, and perhaps most important, we need to go into the psyche ourselves. The object of knowledge is our own most subjective fact. As we travel that dark realm, we can judge it ourselves if Jung offered succor to the task. Only then will we know. It is my own life experience, my own subjective conclusion, that Jung found and offered a pearl beyond value, a light in darkness, and hope for human destiny. The story of love, of Jung's experience of his sexual desiring, and his surrender to love, is central to any comprehension of Jung and his psychology and his Liber Novus. So, we return to the clinical record, the history of a man, and hold in mind this is the story of a man's experience, of a man coming to understand what it is to be a man, to bear a man's longings, a man's body, soul, and spirit. I tell the story with a man's voice, my own voice of comprehension. Only a woman can discern how much this means to her as a woman, or how true it holds to a woman's experience. I would add that history suggests that during Jung's life, women best understood this man. He was surrounded throughout his life by strong, talented, independent women. Remarkable women. And my observation that this is still true. 50 years after his death. Women seem instinctually to understand Jung better than most men. I would be interested to hear why that might be, if any of you have ideas about that. Sex and psychology. This is the clinical history of Jung and sex and love. Jung had an intense relationship to three women during the years from 1902 to 1913, the years leading up to Liber Novus. But it was chaos. Desires, conflicted obligations, intimate sexual acts, and raw emotions. He did not understand what was happening to him. Dr. Jung, psychologist and explorer of the psyche, did not understand. Jung's response to three real women left him puzzling about an inchoate fact in himself, a primal psychic energy he engaged only in and through a woman. He married Emma Rauschenbach in February of 1903. He first confronted Sabina Spielrein as a patient in the fall of 1904. And then Tony, Antonia Wolf, came to him in early 1910. These conjunctions, and particularly the illicit conjunctions, with Sabina and Tony, were fraught with a mythic fascination that simply did not accord with the psychoanalytic sexual theory. The core of all the psychoanalytic concepts Jung was then helping Freud promulgate. In the Eros of Relationship, the rational surface of Jung's life was quaking. A libidinous power was fracturing the crust of Jung's consciousness. Sexuality. Would anyone deny that our individual sexual experience and the sexuality we experience in others plays a major role in human psychology? What is your observation? The assertion that sexuality and its traumas are central factors in human psychology, the scandalous theorem fronted by Freud and Jung in the first decade of the 20th century, has now become almost axiomatic. every clinician dealing with psychological suffering eventually takes some note of this fact. Bisexual reproduction was a revolutionary first step on the evolutionary ladder, leading to the species Homo sapiens. We come to life from bisexual reproduction. Sex is the fact of life in us. While adult males of the species Homo sapiens may or may not think of sex every 7 or 9 minutes, or whatever it was I heard in college, most men and women are reminded of their intrinsic sexuality quite often enough. Thank you. Dogs and cats and cows and horses and Mr. and Miss Moose and bugs on the wall on a hot summer night do something very like what we do. We recognize sex as nature, and we know nature in us. And it is a hell of a problem. Human sexual instincts produce the most bizarre and problematic results, and the most terrible traumas of a human life. I could say more, but you already know enough about this stuff. You live it. It's something we all meet, and with which we must find some understanding. But the problem goes a step further. Sexuality is entwined with love. And while sex is easily tuned to nature, love seems something more. What more? How more? How different or independent love is from sexuality remains the mystery of most human relationship. What was the young Jung's experience? Jung grew up in a home where there was apparently little to no detectable warmth between mother and father. Most of his childhood, Jung's father slept in the same bedroom with Carl and away from his wife. Jung was an isolated and a lonely child. His father seemed a benign enough figure to him, though clearly troubled by issues of faith and perhaps doubt. But his mother really scared him. She suffered some psychological ills and was hospitalized or away on cures for extended periods during his youth. And, of course, she did sometimes have visions of spirits wandering through the house during the night. He was quite surprised and felt embarrassed at age 9 when his mother delivered a baby sister into the family. Jung was never very close to his sister, although she did work for a while as a secretary during, actually, these early years. She died in young adulthood. In character, Jung was a solitary, only child. Those facts should be part of your clinical history. Jung was acculturated into the Calvinistic, Zwinglian, Swiss Reformed Church, Society of Basel. And Basel was at that time still a relatively small city. Sexual promiscuity was not proper for a poor parson's son, and the young Jung seemed concerned with such proprieties. It's unlikely he had any sexual experience before his marriage in 1903, at age 27. Though, of course, that is entirely an unsupportable conjecture. It's just simply my gut feeling, looking at what I know of the man. Sabina Spielroy. What's beyond conjecture and beyond doubt is that Jung became powerfully aware of his sexuality by the time he was 30. Now a young, newly married doctor with female patients and their projections and his projections. Sabina Spielrein became his patient in 1904, and he was 29 years old at the time. 4 years later, in 1908, he was deep in the mire of potentially illicit sex and love, and struggling to understand what was happening. We talked about Dr. Sabina Spielrein last time, and I will here say only a little bit more in review. The basic facts go like this. Sabina Spielrein was a terribly neurotic 19-year-old girl, sent to Zurich by her rich Russian Jewish family to be cured. Jung did his first effort at a psychoanalysis with her in 1904. And here it has to be understood that he had only the most minimal understanding of Freud's theory at the time, and essentially no knowledge of Freud's methods. But an analysis, a talking cure, centered on discussion of sexual repression and erotic fixations that Sabina had, which had been associated perhaps with her father spanking her on her bare buttocks, worked a cure. It worked with Sabina. Obviously, these were extremely intimate conversations. But in that conversation, Sabina found meanings and was able to emerge from a deeply pathological neurotic episode. She enrolled in medical school in Zurich the next year. And Jung eventually had her work in his psychological lab. She became one of his assistants. After a couple of years, they were no longer just doctor and patient. She was a friend who he saw frequently. Sabina fell in love with Jung, of course. Her love was centered in a mythic motif, however. A yearning deep within her own psyche. As she saw it, as she felt it, as she experienced it, she and Jung were to have a child. And that child would be named Siegfried. And Siegfried would be an Aryan Semitic savior. It was crazy. Yes, she knew that. She knew it was crazy. He knew it was crazy. That's the point. But it was the thing rising from her depths. It was a psychic fixation they both tried to analyze and to understand. And to bring to some conscious level of meaning. Not just live it out. Jung also eventually fell in love with Sabina. There's little doubt of this based on his surviving letters to her. I believe her myth of their love, and Jung's own response to that myth was one of the most powerful facts motivating him to both investigate the formidable mythic elements in psychic life and to reject Freud's very reductionistic and materialistic sexual theory. After 6 years struggling with Sabina and the myth of Siegfried, the image of a savior born from their love, mythic motifs of utter transformation in sexual love, I think they probably consummated their relationship. But I would add, it was by then a relatively mature and psychological relationship. They had long enough considered, analyzed, pondered, refused, and sublimated this desire. Only they know what happened. But by Sabina's ecstatic journal account recorded in October of 1910, it seems that they did share some very powerfully experienced event. If it happened. If. But at this point, in October of 1910, they both knew it would not be an enduring affair. Sabina was just a few months away from medical school graduation and her departure from Zurich. So they parted in 1911 with many things unresolved. Questions lingered for them both. And now, they were both physicians, psychoanalysts, physicians of the soul, who both knew about the wound of sexuality and love, and a mythic power that could confound those relationships. Oh my, there are things we say in youth, and perhaps letters we write, that should not be seen or read by others. Jung wrote such a letter to Sabina in 1908. By some trick of fate, it came to light, to be read by those who might never understand. I must read it to you, because I want you to understand a human story, a clinical history. I have abbreviated a few sections here. This letter tells much about young Dr. Jung in love. Jung is 33 years old when he writes this to 21-year-old Sabina in December of 1908. Their parting is still 2 years away. My dear, I regret so much. I regret my weakness and curse the fate that is threatening me. I fear for my work, for my life's task, for all the lofty perspectives that are being revealed to me by this new philosophy as it evolves. How shall I, with my sensitive soul, free myself from all these questions? My mind is torn to its very depths. I, who had to be a tower of strength for many weak people, am the weakest of all. Will you forgive me for being as I am? For offending you by being like this, and forgetting my duties as a doctor toward you? Will you understand that I am one of the weakest and most unstable of human beings? And will you never take revenge on me for that, either in words or in thoughts or feelings? I am looking for someone who understands how to love without punishing the other person, imprisoning him, or sucking him dry. I am seeking this as yet unrealized person who will make it possible that love can be independent of social advantage and disadvantage, so that love may always be an end in itself, and not just a means to an end. It is my misfortune that I cannot live without the joy of love, of tempestuous, ever-changing love in my life. This daimon stands as an unholy contradiction to my compassion and my sensitivity. What on earth is to be done for the best? I do not know and dare not say, because I do not know what you will make of my words and feelings. Give me back now something of the love and patience and unselfishness which I was able to give you at the time of your illness. Now I am ill. End quote. Jung had no method of comprehension. It made no sense. A noumen and daimon, devoid of name, had awakened and it could not be conceptualized or analyzed to nullity or ethically damned as irrelevant carnality. It lived in him, and it wanted expression. It had to be met. In his letter to Sabina, Jung spoke of love. He said, "It is my misfortune that I cannot live without the joy of love, of tempestuous, ever-changing love in my life. This daimon stands as an unholy contradiction to my compassion and my sensitivity." Was Jung talking about love? Huh? Love? This was wild love. Free love, ecstatic love, the joy of love tempestuous, ever-changing, love without obligation. This is love in, oh, I don't know, San Francisco, summer of 1967 love. Perhaps it seems it was more sexual desiring than what 6 years later Jung would understand by the word love. Love was still a distant mystery to him, a thing he did not know, an unmet and unbearable longing. The German word Jung used to describe this power in the Liber Novus is, in German, die Lust, lust. In German, this word, die Lust, is much more than the dark sexual impulse the word lust conveys in English. It is a desiring, a longing, an instinctual craving, and pleasure, pleasure itself, the pleasure. Jung was ill with die Lust, a desiring. And he did not understand it. It was the contradiction in him, the antithesis to his compassion and sensitivity, the thoughtful self-image which he preferred, to which he gave honor and considered his strength. Die Lust was illness and weakness. He said to Sabina, "I regret my weakness and curse the fate that is threatening me. I fear for my work, for my life's task, for all the lofty perspectives." Fear for his life task. What was this event doing to him? Young Dr. Jung, married, a leader in this new psychoanalytic movement associated with Freud, having an affair with a young woman, discovering himself the most unstable of all men. He said, "My mind is torn to its very depths." And he was asking Sabina to be his doctor, his therapist to this love. "Give me back now something of the love and patience and unselfishness which I gave to you at the time of your illness. Now I am ill." Doctor and patient, man and woman, sex and love. He said, "Now I am ill. Some illness. Perhaps some of you have been in this situation, suffered these sorts of things. Maybe I have too, or maybe not. But I recognize this is a fact of life and sexuality, and that it is the path of torment some men trod in search of love." Jung was struggling to understand the forces inside of him, the psychic facts that worked this torment. It made no sense. He could not analyze this one out. He was wounded. He was ill. Over the next years, Jung imagined there was perhaps a typological issue to be considered in this wounding. Though, of course, his book about psychological typology was still a decade in the future. Jung suspected he was, by nature, a thinker. And he witnessed other people were different. Some people seemed more at home in feeling. His sexuality, his sensate nature, and the dark wellspring of his feelings, including the mystery of love, were for him at age 35 a place of mystery, disorder, and threatening dissolution. It was a swamp in the dark of night and full of snakes. It was home of the dread worm. It was his unmet, unintegrated desiring, die Lust. Love lurked somewhere on the outside of this swamp, on the other side of it. Unbearable longing drove him on through. If you were a thinker, and scarred and wizened enough by life, then you may know what I mean. Or, if you were anything but a thinking type, and have been intensely in relationship with a thinking type, oh, curse of curses, you may have suffered through some of these issues. And as a therapist, you have undoubtedly met the result. Jung's great book on psychological types, written mostly in 1919 and published in 1921, and which many years later became the basis of the Myers-Briggs personality assessment. This work germinated in this quest to understand the yet unnamed facts he was recognizing during these years. Tony Wolf. In 1910, as his relationship with Sabina ended, Antonia Anna Wolf, Tony Wolf, as she was known by her family and friends throughout her life, entered his life. She was the daughter of a wealthy, well-established, and aristocratic family of Zurich. Stunningly intelligent, sensitive, and intensely introverted. When at age 21 she was brought by her mother to Jung for treatment, Toni was suffering deeply. Her sorrow and despair were almost mythologic in intensity. In the next year or two of work with Jung, and with the aid of his developing analytic sense of mythology, of mythological motifs in the psyche, Tony apparently found a doorway of understanding and of meaning. Her suffering abated. Call it a severe depression, if you will, but understand that whatever it is named, it forever remains her own mystery. She found help and a friend in Jung. A deep interest in his psychological work awakened, and she became his assistant. She aided with his research in mythology during these important years. In the winter of 1912-1913, at the very threshold of the events that would produce Liber Novus, Carl Jung realized he loved this woman. He loved her. And he had to experience love. Jung needed love. He needed to find the depths of love. He could not live without this love. The visionary events Jung recorded in his Black Book ledgers between the fall of 1913 and the spring of 1914, form the foundation of the first two parts of Liber Novus, Liber Primus, Liber Secundus. Jung witnessed these core events of Liber Novus in a period of just about 9 months. Then, in the next fall and winter, in late 1914 and 1915, he transcribed a draft manuscript, adding his layer of commentary to the visions. This handwritten draft manuscript, Tony Wolf typed up for him. Work then began on the first calligraphic and illustrated parchment folios of the Red Book in 1915. During these specific months, of delving into the mythopoetic imagination, the imaginal layers of the psyche. Jung was consummating this love relationship with Toni Wolff, a relationship he would honor for the rest of his life. I do not believe one can understand the soulful story in Liber Novus and the depths of desiring and love that Jung was facing in Liber Novus. The resolving balance of earth and spirit and the mystery of love without weighing in the human story of Jung's love for Toni. It was transformative. Toni Wolff was not to be Jung's mistress. They remained together until her death in 1953 at age 64. Toni Wolff became Carl Gustav Jung's second wife, a role for which there was no proper social description in Swiss society, and a situation with very limited acceptance in the most liberal European culture of the time. Except among the Mormons, it was a bond without any social honor in America. Jung remained married to Emma. After some years of understandable disorder, Emma and Toni accepted each other and were ultimately sympathetic to each other. Perhaps one could say that Emma and Toni became friends, but it was unlike any friendship most of us will meet. The three, Carl, Emma, and Toni, were frequently and very comfortably together in public. Toni was at the private family dinner table every Sunday with Carl and Emma and their children. They, all three of them, shared private time each with the other. When Jung traveled outside the country in the 1920s and 30s, sometimes Toni accompanied him, and sometimes Emma. And sometimes they were all together. Emma did not much like staying at the very Spartan tower hermitage Jung built at Bollingen on the upper shore of Lake Zurich beginning around 1923. And Toni was often there with him. These relationships, especially in the first years, were understandably a passage through rough, uncharted waters, and it was not easy navigating. But it was, and remained, a fact of their lives. Much, much later in life, Jung's wife, Emma, is said, at least as recalled by Barbara Hanna, is said to have spoken these words, and I quote, "You see, he never took anything from me to give to Toni. But the more he gave her, the more he seemed able to give to me." End quote. It seems, as Jung learned to love Toni, he learned how to love. Is that comprehensible? What happened between Carl and Tony in 1914? And during the years Jung struggled with the depths, has remained the deepest and perhaps unspeakable mystery of Jung's history. It really has never been adequately understood. During their life, this relationship was respected by those who knew them and was not a subject for public comment. After their deaths, however, several people aware of the situation did make some comment. They felt it was a story that had to be known, had to be commented. And the absence of any mention about Tony in Memories, Dreams, Reflections was painful to those who had been their friends. And here I must, of course, again add, note, that Jung did speak about his relationship with Tony in conversation with Anjelia Jaffe around 1957, as he was telling the tale that would become Memories, Dreams, Reflections. But those comments were edited out of the final compilation that became the text of Memories, Dreams, Reflections. They are available in manuscript of what are known as the protocols, the interviews between Jung and Anjelia Jaffe. And a copy is in the Library of Congress, and a copy is in the Jung Archive in Zurich. In his 1975 biography, Jung and the Story of Our Time, Lawrence von der Post, the distinguished South African soldier, statesman, writer, and singular friend of Jung during later life, made, I think, the best attempt at telling their private story. I highly suggest you read this book. It is perhaps the most deeply felt, personal, and insightful biography of Jung, and it is written by a man who knew him well. Von der Post says in summary, and I quote, "Throughout these long years, Tony Wolff stood fast, and in the process, not only sustained the full weight of Jung's undiscovered feminine self, enabling him thereby to live it out through her into maturity, but inevitably became also the vulnerable intermediary between himself and his embattled shadow. Years later, when the projection could be withdrawn and received back with honor by its first cause in Jung's spirit, it must have been as if, somewhere on the margins of the universe, trumpets were sounding for them." Remember those words we talked about in our last session? Projection, transference. Tony sustained Jung's undiscovered feminine self. She held a transference. She held the projection, allowing him thereby to live it out into maturity, into conscious relationship through her, to discover it, to come to terms with it. I think that is an accurate statement, or at least one brief way of describing what happened. Tony stood with him. She heard him out, and she supported him. She gave him insight into what was happening to him. She personally did not fall into the visionary and imaginative world Jung was exploring. She remained more an anchor in reality and gave a candid perspective and a complete acceptance of the reality of the imaginative depths he was indeed probing. It was not easy. It must have been profoundly difficult. Jung said privately to Barbara Hanna late in life, speaking of Tony, and the difficult burden she had accepted, and the gift of love that sustained him during the creation of Libra Novus. He said privately these words, "She loved me. It was nothing short of heroism. Such things stand forever, and I shall be grateful to her in all eternity." And Emma said to a friend late in her own life, as recounted by Lawrence van der Post, speaking about Tony's relationship with Jung in these years, and here I quote Emma's words, "I shall always be grateful to Tony for doing for my husband what I or anyone else could not have done for him at a most critical time." End quote. It is a mystery of love. In February of 1944, Jung slipped in the snow and broke his ankle. This modest injury and the perhaps overly tight cast placed on his leg and the associated immobilization led to the development of a blood clot in his leg and to development 12 days later of a life-threatening pulmonary embolus and subsequent heart attack. There was no treatment for this in 1944, at least no very effective treatment. For 3 weeks, Jung hung between life and death. In that twilight, he was immersed in a prolonged series of visions. They seemed the end of his journey, the conclusion to the story he had lived. Of them, he says in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and I quote, "It is impossible to convey the beauty and intensity of emotions during those visions. They were the most tremendous thing I have ever experienced. I would never have imagined that any such experience was possible. It was not a product of imagination. The visions and experiences were utterly real. There was nothing subjective about them. They had all a quality of absolute objectivity." We shy away from the word eternal, but I can describe the experience only as the ecstasy of a non-temporal state in which past, present, and future are one. Everything that happened in time had been brought together into a concrete whole. nothing was distributed over time. Nothing could be measured by temporal concepts. End quote. Jung tells the story of these visions and how they changed or reoriented his perspective, how he was changed by them in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Barbara Hahn, in her biography of Jung, described the visions as Jung's second initiation. She felt that his first initiation, using the metaphor of a shamanistic medicine man, his first initiation had been the events, the visions of Liber Novus. This was his second and more final passage. They were transformative. Jung tells the story of the visions in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, and you should read that section. The visions came in three sections, in three parts. And I will abbreviate briefly as I read. Jung states, I myself was, so it seemed, in the pardes remomnum, the garden of pomegranates, and the wedding of Tifereth and Malkuth was taking place. Now this is a Kabbalistic imagery that I will not try to explain here. At bottom, it was I myself. I was the marriage, and my beatitude was that of a blissful wedding. There followed the marriage of the Lamb, in a Jerusalem festively bedecked. I cannot describe what it was like in detail. There were ineffable states of joy. Angels were present and light. I myself was the marriage of the Lamb. This too vanished, and there came a new image, the last vision. I walked up a wide valley to the end, where a gentle chain of hills began. The valley ended in a classical amphitheater. It was magnificently situated in the green landscape. And there, in this theater, the Hieros Gamos was being celebrated. And Jung's words, I was the wedding. The journey had started in Liber Novus with Jung's petition to his soul, whom he found again only through the soul of the woman. The woman was Toni Wolff. She had subsequently offered herself in form of Salome as a bride. He had followed the trail of that elusive, mystical wedding across the ages. Now his story had reached its experiential conclusion. Jung had entered the bridal chamber. He had met the bride. I was the marriage. Jung entered the greatest mystery of love, a conjunctio within his own self. It was the mystery he had sought to understand all of his life. Now he experienced it. I can describe the experience only as the ecstasy of a non-temporal state. in which present, past, and future are one. Everything that happens in time had been brought together into a concrete whole. After these visions, Jung published his last quartet of works, his summary statement. These works all circle back to Liber Novus. They are his last commentary on the events of Liber Novus. Until the publication of the Red Book in 2009, no one understood this fact. In 1945, at the age of 70, Jung published his commentary on a 16th century alchemical text, the Rosarium Philosophorum. He titled the book The Psychology of the Transference, and he dedicated it to my wife. This is the opening movement to Jung's last quartet. The four summary volumes published after these near-death visions of the Hieros Gamos in 1944. These four final works, The Psychology of the Transference, Ion, Answer to Job, and Mysterium Conjunctionis, offer an intricate exegesis on Liber Novus and the mythopoetic experience that forms foundation to all Jung's life work. Formed near the end of his life and completed after a second extraordinary visionary experience, each of these works provides a uniquely focused elaboration and final testament to the numinous beginning recorded in Liber Novus. Everything else is to be derived from this. No prefigured motive designed this last quartet. As Jung explained, and I quote, "The vision of the end of all things gave me the courage to undertake new formulations. I no longer attempted to put across my own opinion, but surrendered myself to the current of my thoughts." End quote. These four unique works, once reflected, disclose the currents carrying Jung, and they all eddy round the rock of Liber Novus. Jung was turning his story about, shining a summary light of consciousness upon the flow of his life. Psychology of the Transference is the first key offered up by this stream of thought. It might imaginatively be called the first of four keys, each worked in different mode, that unlock the human experience documented in Liber Novus. This exegesis on an ancient alchemical text is Jung's veiled and most explicit meditation on what happened in his relationship with Toni. His transference upon her, while at the same time his soul revealed herself inwardly, and thus led him toward the supreme meaning and mystery of conjunction. This book, published in 1946, should be read as Jung's revelation concerning the personal events inaugurating and sustaining Liber Novus. At the threshold of his passage into this mystery, Jung faced his carnal desire, die Lust. There was a man and a woman and a profound longing. When Jung discovered the Rosarium Philosophorum and its series of symbolic alchemical engravings, he found the story of his own alchemy of transformation. The 10 images he elucidates in his commentary, which unfortunately I cannot here display or adequately describe, these 10 images are highly symbolic, but they are also blatantly sexual. They illustrate the adept, the male alchemist, and his female companion or mystical sister, the soror mystica, disrobing and entering a vessel of transformation. To Jung, these were not arcane symbols. They were an event he had experienced. They were not symbols. They were real. He saw the mystery within this arcane series of engravings because he had lived this arcanum and this process of transformation. As he states in Psychology of the Transference, and I quote, "The strongest instincts," and here let me add, read that as die Lust and the sexual instincts. Let me start again. "The strongest instincts undoubtedly demand concrete realization and generally enforce it. But they cannot be considered exclusively biological, since the course they actually follow is subject to powerful modifications from the personality itself. If a man's temperament inclines him to a spiritual attitude, even the concrete activity of the instincts, these sexual instincts, this desiring, let me add, even the concrete activity of the instincts will take on a certain symbolical character. This activity is no longer the mere satisfaction of instinctual impulses, for it is now associated with, or complicated by, meanings, unquote. Jung was certainly a man inclined to a spiritual attitude, but he was also a man dealing with concrete instincts. His body, his desirings, his sexuality. Accepting human relationship and accepting and integrating the fact of these longings led Jung to complicated meanings. Life facts intermingle in his relationship to the feminine fact he encountered in his soul. That raw history of desire underlies the dialogues of Liber Novus. We witness die Lust becoming a passage to love. Outer life is touching a mythical inner life. Man lives in two worlds. The worlds touch in the mercurial font of human relationship with a real woman. A woman he touched. A woman who touched him. He came to this experience with conflicts and questions formed from his own life facts. Jung confronted the worm, the serpent power, in his sexuality, and then struggled to understand what three women had done to his psyche. And he discovered that the serpent bore both a poison and a healing. He perceived the noumen and daimon of sexuality had both a psychic and a somatic reality. To these two, a third and separate spiritual reality conjoined, petitioning its place. Life facts intermingle in his developing relationship to the feminine fact of his soul. This raw human history is working in the dialogues of Liber Novus. It is a man's story. The story of a man coming to terms with desiring, with sexuality, with woman, and with the mystery of love. Around 1957, 4 years before his death, Jung gave his final statement about his psychology and about the question of sexuality that had first been raised by Sigmund Freud. I quote here from Memories, Dreams, Reflections. It is a widespread error to imagine that I do not see the value of sexuality. On the contrary, it plays a large part in my psychology as an essential, though not the sole expression of psychic wholeness. But my main concern has been to investigate, over and above its personal significance and biological function, its spiritual aspect and its numinous meaning, and thus to explain what Freud was so fascinated by but was unable to grasp. My thoughts on this subject are contained in The Psychology of the Transference and The Mysterium Conjunctionis. The first and the last books of his final quartet, I add in footnote, And I continue. Sexuality is of the greatest importance as the expression of the thonic, the earth spirit. That spirit is the other face of God, the dark side of the God image. The question of the thonic spirit has occupied me ever since I began to delve into the world of alchemy. Unquote. And in these words, understand that Jung knew he had first begun delving into the world of alchemy, alchemical practice, in 1913. He entered that alembic with Tony Wolfe and with the visions that became Liber Novus. I would like to conclude with words recounted by Gerhard Wehr in his 1985 biography of Jung. These are words that have haunted me since I first read them many years ago. There recounts an interview between Miguel Serrano, an interview that took place 2 years before Jung's death. And here I quote Gerhard Wehr. The moment of parting had come. Guest and host knew there was not enough strength for more. Jung's daughter and son-in-law were at the door waiting for their father. Miguel Serrano had written down many thoughts that united the two. But one thought, one image, one dream had made an indelible impression on him. It came from a previous meeting when Jung was speaking as if to himself and said, "Once there was a flower, a stone, a crystal, a queen, a king, a palace, a lover and his beloved. Somewhere, a long, long time ago, on an island in the middle of the sea, 5,000 years ago, such a thing as love, the mystical flower of the soul. That is the center of the self." Then Jung went on, as if in a dream, saying, "Nobody understands what I mean. Only a poet could sense it." Serrano said, "But you are really a poet yourself. And this woman, is she still alive?" As if emerging from mythical pasts and returning to the historical dimension, Jung answered, letting the other have the clue to the riddle, to the extent it was necessary at all. She died 8 years ago. I am very old. Whether this date was accurate and was based on an exact reference in their conversations, or whether these words, spoken in 1959, referred to Toni Wolff, who had died 6 years earlier, in 1953, may never be known. But if this were so, it would emphasize once more that the intimate relationship between her and Jung was much more than a friendship between two people, at which the over-righteous may take offense. End quote. Such is the mystery of Jung in love. Thank you.